back to look at Volta, who now seemed to have trouble keeping eye contact.
"Who did you train under?" Rowan asked.
"Scythe Nehru."
Rowan seemed to recall Scythe Faraday chatting with Scythe Nehru during Conclave. They appeared to be on good terms. "How does he feel about you hanging around with Goddard?"
"To you, he's Honorable Scythe Goddard," Volta said, a bit indignant. "And I couldn't care less how Scythe Nehru feels. Old guard scythes have obsolete ideas. They're too set in their ways to see the wisdom of the change."
He spoke of the change as if it were a tangible thing. A thing that, by its very weight, could make a person strong simply by pushing it. They stopped at a pair of wrought iron gates, which slowly swung open to admit them.
"Here we are," said Volta.
A quarter-mile driveway ended at a palatial estate. A servant greeted them and led them into the mansion. Rowan was immediately assaulted by loud dance music. There were people everywhere, reveling as if it were New Year's Eve. The whole estate seemed to undulate in the throes of the relentless beat, people laughing, drinking, and laughing some more. Some of the guests were scythes, and not just Goddard's obvious disciples, other scythes as well. There were also some minor celebrities. The rest seemed to be beautiful people, who were probably professional party guests. His friend Tiger aspired to be one of those. A lot of kids said that, but Tiger really meant it. The servant led them out back to a huge pool that seemed more suited to a resort than a home. There were waterfalls and a swim-up bar, and more beautiful people happily bobbing. Scythe Goddard was in a cabana beyond the deep end, its front open to the festivities before him. He was attended by more than one fawning bimbotech. He wore his signature royal blue robe, but as Rowan got closer, he could see it was a sheerer variation than the one he had worn at Conclave. His leisure robe. Rowan wondered if the man had a diamond-studded bathing suit in his wardrobe as well.
"Rowan Damish," said Scythe Goddard as they approached.
He told a servant passing with a tray of drinks to give Rowan a glass of champagne. When Rowan didn't take it, Scythe Volta grabbed one and put it in Rowan's hand, before disappearing into the throng, leaving Rowan to fend for himself.
"Please, enjoy," said Goddard. "I serve only Dom Perignon."
Rowan took a sip, wondering if an underage scythe's apprentice could get marked down for drinking. Then he remembered that such rules didn't apply to him anymore, so he took another sip.
"I arranged this little bacchanal in your honor,"
the scythe said, gesturing to the party around them.
"What do you mean, in my honor?"
"Exactly that. This is your party. Do you like it?"
The surreal display of excess was even more intoxicating than the champagne. But did he like it? Mostly he just felt weird, and weirder still to know that he was the guest of honor.
"I don't know. I've never had a party before," Rowan told him.
It was true. His parents had seen so many birthdays by the time Rowan was born, they had stopped celebrating them. He was lucky if they even remembered to get him a gift.
"Well then," said Scythe Goddard, "let this be the first of many."
Rowan had to remind himself that this man, with the perfect smile, secreting charisma instead of sweat, was the man who had manipulated him and Citra into mortal competition. But it was hard not to be dazzled by his style, and as distasteful as all this spectacle was, it still made his adrenaline flow. The scythe patted the seat beside him for Rowan to sit, and Rowan took his place at the scythe's right hand.
"Doesn't the Eighth Commandment say that a scythe can't own anything but his robe, ring, and a journal?"
"Correct," said Scythe Goddard brightly. "And I own none of this. The food is donated by generous benefactors, the guests are here by choice, and this fine estate has been graciously loaned to me for as long as I choose to grace its halls."
Upon the mention of the estate, a man cleaning the pool looked up at them for a moment before returning to his labors.
"You should reread the commandments," Scythe Goddard said. "You'll find that nothing in them demands that scythes shun the creature comforts that make life worth living. That bleak interpretation by old guard scythes is a relic from another time."
Rowan did not offer any further opinion on the subject. It was Scythe Faraday's humble and serious old guard nature that had made an impression on Rowan. Had he been approached by Scythe Goddard with enticements of rock star glamour in exchange for the taking of lives, he would have declined. But Faraday was dead, and Rowan was here,
looking out on strangers that were here for his benefit. If it's my party, shouldn't it have people I know?
A scythe is a friend to the world. Open your arms and embrace it.
It seemed Scythe Goddard had an answer for everything.
Your life is about to change, Rowan Damish, he said, waving his arm to indicate the pool and the partiers and the servants and the elaborate spread of food just past the shallow end that kept being replenished. In fact, it already has.
Among the party guests was a girl who seemed markedly out of place. She was young, 9 or 10 at the most, and completely oblivious to the party around her as she frolicked in the shallow end of the pool.
It looks like one of your guests brought their kid to the party, Rowan commented.
That, said Goddard, is Esme,
and you would be wise to treat her well. She is the most important person you will meet today.
How so?
That chubby little girl is the key to the future. So you'd better hope she likes you.
Rowan would have continued picking at Goddard's enigmatic responses, but his attention was grabbed by a beautiful party girl approaching in a bikini that seemed almost painted on. Rowan realized a moment too late that he was staring. She grinned and he blushed, looking away.
Ariadne, would you be so kind as to give my apprentice a massage?
Yes, Your Honor, said the girl.
Maybe later, Rowan said. Nonsense, said the scythe. You need to loosen up, and Ariadne has magical hands, skilled in Swedish technique. Your body will thank you.
She took Rowan by the hand, and that killed any resistance. He rose and let himself be led away.
If our young man is pleased by your efforts, Scythe Goddard called after them, I will allow you to kiss my ring.
As Ariadne led him to the massage tent, Rowan thought, in 8 months, I am going to die. So, perhaps he could allow himself a little indulgence on the way.
I am disturbed by those who revere us far more than those who disdain us. Too many put us on a pedestal. Too many long to be one of us. And knowing that they can never be makes their longing even greater, for all scythes are apprenticed in their youth. It is either naivete in thinking that we are somehow of a higher order of being, or it is the product of a depraved heart. For who but the depraved would revel in the taking of life? For a time, years ago, there were groups who would emulate and imitate us. They would fashion robes like those of scythes. They would wear rings that looked similar to ours. For many it was just costume play, but some would actually pretend to be scythes, fooling others, granting false immunity, everything short of gleaning. There are laws against impersonating workers in any profession, but no law preventing anyone from impersonating a scythe. Since the Thunderhead has no jurisdiction over the scythedom, it cannot pass any laws concerning us. It was an unforeseen glitch in the separation of scythe and state. However, it wasn't a glitch for long. In the year of the Stingray, at the 63rd World Conclave, it was decided that all such impostors shall be gleaned on sight, publicly and most violently. While one might expect such an edict to produce a bloodbath, very few gleanings ever took place. Once word got out, the posers shed their false robes and vanished into the woodwork of the world. To this day, the edict remains, but rarely needs to be invoked, because few are foolish enough to impersonate a scythe. And yet, now and again, I hear at Conclave the rare tale of a scythe coming face to face with an impostor and having to glean them. Usually the conversation is about the inconvenience of it, how the scythe must then track down the impostor's family to grant immunity and such. But I wonder more about the impostor. What was it they hoped to achieve? Was it the lure of the forbidden? Were they enticed by the danger of being caught? Or did they simply wish to leave this life so badly that they chose one of the few direct paths to annihilation?
From the Gleaning Journal of H.S. Curie. 21. Branded. The party continued for another day, a festival of excess on all levels. Rowan joined in the revelry, but it was more out of obligation than anything. He was the center of attention, the celebrity of the moment,
In the pool, beautiful people bobbed toward him. At the buffet, guests cleared the way so he could always be at the front of the line. It was awkward, yet heady. He couldn't deny that there was a part of him that enjoyed the surreal nature of celebratory attention. The lettuce, elevated to a place of honor. It was only when the other scythes in attendance shook his hand and wished him luck in his mortal competition against Citra that he sobered and remembered what was at stake. He borrowed brief snippets of sleep in the cabana, always awakened by music or raucous laughter or fireworks. Then, late in the afternoon of the second day, when Scythe Goddard had enough, he merely whispered so, and word spread quickly. In less than an hour the guests had left, and servants began to clean the detritus of revelry from the eerily silent grounds. Now only the other residents of the estate remained. Scythe Goddard, his three junior scythes, the servants and the girl Esme, who peered out of her bedroom window at Rowan like a wraith as he sat in Goddard's cabana, awaiting whatever came next. Scythe Volta approached, his yellow robes rippling in the breeze.
"What are you still doing out here?"
he asked.
"I have nowhere else to be," Rowan told him.
"Come with me,"
Volta said.
"It's time to begin your training."
There was a wine cellar in the basement of the main house. Hundreds, perhaps thousands of bottles of wine rested in brick alcoves. A bare minimum of bulbs lit the space, casting long shadows and making the alcoves seem like portals to undisclosed hells. Scythe Volta led Rowan to the central chamber of the cellar, where Goddard and the other scythes waited. Scythe Rand produced a device from her green robe. It looked like a cross between a gun and a flashlight.
"Do you know what this is?"
she asked.
"It's a tweaker," Rowan told her.
He'd had the occasion several years ago to have his nanites tweaked when his teachers decided his moodiness had crossed the line into depression. That was 5 or 6 years ago. The tweaking was painless, and the effect subtle. He hadn't noticed much of a change, but everyone agreed that he had begun to smile more.
"Arms out, legs spread," said Scythe Rand.
Rowan did as he was told, and Scythe Rand passed the tweaker all over his body, like some sort of magic wand. Rowan felt a mild tingling in his extremities that quickly faded. She stepped back, and Scythe Goddard approached.
"Have you ever heard the expression, being made?" asked Scythe Goddard. "Or being jumped in?"
Rowan shook his head, noticing that the other scythes had positioned themselves around him, leaving Rowan at the center of their circle.
"Well, you are about to find out what it means."
The other scythes then removed their cumbersome outer robes. Now down to their tunics and knickers, they took aggressive stances. There was a look of determination on each of their faces, and maybe a bit of joyous anticipation. Rowan knew what was about to happen an instant before it began. Scythe Chomsky, the largest of them, stepped forward, and without warning swung his fist, connecting with Rowan's cheek so hard he spun around, lost his footing, and fell to the dusty floor. Rowan felt the shock of the punch, the jagged bolt of pain, and waited for the telltale warmth of his nanites releasing pain-killing opiates into his bloodstream. But relief didn't come. Instead, the pain swelled. It was horrible, overwhelming. Rowan had never experienced such pain. He never knew such pain could exist.
"What did you do?" he wailed. "What did you do to me?"
"We turned off your nanites," Scythe Volta said calmly, "so you could experience what our ancestors once did."
"There's a very old expression," Scythe Goddard told him. "To be painless is to be gainless."
He gripped Rowan warmly on the shoulder. "And I wish you to gain much." Then he stood back, signaled the others to advance, and they began to beat Rowan to a pulp. Recovery without the aid of healing nanites was a slow, miserable process that seemed to get worse before it got better. The first day Rowan longed to die. The second day he thought he actually might. His head pounded, his thoughts swam. He slipped in and out of consciousness with little warning. It was hard to breathe, and he knew he had several broken ribs. And although Scythe Chomsky had painfully popped his dislocated shoulder back into place at the end of his beating, it still ached with each heartbeat. Scythe Volta visited him several times a day. He sat with Rowan, spoon-feeding him soup, and blotting where it spilled from his split, swollen lips. There seemed to be a halo around him, but Rowan knew it was just optical damage that caused the effect. He wouldn't be surprised if he had detached retinas.
"It burns,"
he told Volta, as the salty soup spilled over his lips.
"It does, for now,"
Volta told him, with genuine compassion.
"But it will pass, and you'll be better for it."
"How could I be better for any of this?"
he asked, horrified at how distorted and liquid his words sounded, as if he were speaking through the blowhole of a whale. Volta fed him another spoonful of soup.
"6 months from now? You tell me if I was right."
He thanked Volta for taking the time to visit him when no one else did.
"You can call me Alessandro," Volta said.
"Is that your real name?"
Rowan asked.
"No, idiot. It's Volta's first name."
Rowan supposed that's as close as anyone got to knowing anyone else in the Scythedom.
"Thank you, Alessandro."
On the evening of the second day, the girl, the one who Goddard said was so important, came into his room in between deliriums. What was her name again? Amy? Emmy? Oh yes, Esme.
"I hate that they did this to you,"
she said with tears in her eyes.
"But you'll get better."
Of course he'd get better. He didn't have any choice in the matter. In mortal days, one died or recovered. Now there was only one option.
"Why are you here?"
"To see how you were getting on," she said.
"No, I mean, here, in this place."
She hesitated before she spoke. Then she looked away.
"Scythe Goddard and his friends came to a mall near where I lived. They gleaned everyone in the food court except for me. Then he told me to come with him, so I did."
It didn't explain anything. But it was the only explanation she offered, perhaps the only one she knew. From what Rowan could see, this girl served no discernible function at the estate. Yet Goddard gave orders that anyone who ran afoul of her would be severely disciplined. She was not to be bothered in any way and was allowed free run of the estate. She was the biggest mystery he'd encountered yet in Scythe Goddard's world.
"I think you'll be a better Scythe than the others," she told him,
but gave no explanation as to why she thought so. Perhaps it was a gut feeling, but she couldn't be more wrong.
I won't be a Scythe, he told her.
She was the first person he'd confessed it to.
"You will, if you want to,"
she said.
"And I think you'll want to."
Then she left him to ponder the pain and the possibility. Scythe Goddard didn't show his face in Rowan's room until day 3.
"How are you feeling?"
he asked. Rowan wanted to spit at him, but knew it would hurt too much, and it might even bring about a second beating.
"How do you think I'm feeling?"
Rowan answered. He sat on the edge of the bed and studied Rowan's face.
"Come, see yourself."
Then he helped Rowan out of the bed, and Rowan hobbled to an ornate wardrobe on which was a full-length mirror. Rowan barely recognized himself. His face was so swollen it was pumpkin-like. Purple bruises all over his face and body were mottling to all shades of the spectrum.
"Here is where your life begins," Goddard told him. "What you see is the boy dying. The man will emerge."
"That's such a load of crap," Rowan said,
not even caring what response it might evoke. Goddard merely raised an eyebrow.
"Perhaps, but you can't deny this is a turning point in your life, and every turning point must be marked by an event. One that burns itself into you as indelibly as a brand."
So, now he was branded. Yet he suspected this was just the beginning of a much larger trial by fire.
"The world longs to be like us," Goddard told Rowan, "taking and doing what we choose, with neither consequence nor remorse. They would steal our robes and wear them if they could. You have been given an opportunity to become greater than royalty. So at the very least it requires this rite of passage that I have provided for you."
Goddard stood there, studying Rowan a few moments more. Then he pulled out the tweaker from his robes.
"Arms up, legs spread."
Rowan took as deep a breath as he could and did as he was told. Goddard wanded him. Rowan felt tingling in his extremities, but when it was done, he didn't feel the warmth of opiates or the deadening of his pain.
"It's still hurts,
Rowan told him. Of course it does. I didn't activate your painkillers, just your healing nanites. You'll be good as new by morning, and ready to begin your training. But from this moment on, you'll feel every measure of your body's pain.
Why?
Rowan dared to ask.
What person in their right mind would want to feel that kind of pain?
Right-mindedness is overrated, Goddard said. I'd rather have a mind that's clear than one that's right.
In the business of death, we scythes have no competition. Unless, of course, you consider fire. Fire kills just as swiftly and completely as a scythe's blade. It's frightening, but also somehow comforting to know that there's one thing the Thunderhead can't fix. One type of damage that revival centers are powerless to undo. Once one's goose is cooked, it is truly and permanently cooked. Death by fire is the only natural death left. It almost never happens, though. The Thunderhead monitors heat on every inch of the planet, and the fighting of fires often begins before one can even smell smoke. There are safety systems in every home and every office building, with multiple levels of redundancy just in case. The more extreme tone cults try to burn their deadish, to make it permanent, but ambudrones usually get to them first. Isn't it good to know that we are all safe from the threat of the inferno? Except, of course, when we're not. From the Gleaning Journal of H.S. Curie. 22. Sign of the Bident. Citra's days were filled with training and gleaning. Each day, Citra would go out with Scythe Curie to towns that were selected completely at random. She would watch as the scythe prowled the streets and malls and parks, becoming like a lioness in search of vulnerable prey. Citra learned to see the signs of the stagnant, as Scythe Curie called them. Although Citra was not as convinced as she about their readiness to be gleaned. Citra wondered how many of her own days had been filled with world weariness before becoming an apprentice to death. If Scythe Curie had come across Citra on one of those days, would the woman have gleaned her? They passed an elementary school one day as it was letting out, and Citra had a sinking feeling that she would glean one of the students.
I never glean children,
Scythe Curie told her. I've never found a child who seemed stagnant, but even if I did, I wouldn't do it. I've been admonished in conclave about it, but they've never taken disciplinary action against me.
Scythe Faraday had no such rule. He had been strictly about statistics from the age of mortality. Fewer pre-adolescents died in those days, but they did die on occasion. In their time together, Citra had known him to do only one such gleaning. He did not invite Rowan or her, and at dinner that night he broke into uncontrollable sobbing and had to excuse himself. If Citra was ordained, she vowed to follow a policy like Scythe Curie, even if it got her in trouble with the selection committee. Almost every night, she and the scythe would prepare dinner for mourning family members. Most would leave with their spirits lifted. Some would remain inconsolable, resentful, hateful, but they were in the minority. Such was life and death for Citra in the days before the harvest conclave. She couldn't help but think of Rowan and wonder how he was faring. She longed to see him, but she dreaded it at the same time because she knew, in a few short months, she'd be seeing him for the last time, one way or another. And she held on to the narrow hope that if she could prove Scythe Faraday was taken out by a fellow scythe, perhaps that could be a monkey wrench hurled into the relentless gearworks of the scythedom. A monkey wrench that would free Citra from having to glean or be gleaned by Rowan. Most of the bereaved that Citra had to notify were the same. Husbands, wives, children, parents. At first, she had resented that Scythe Curie made her the front line for these heartbroken people. But soon she came to understand why. It wasn't so that Scythe Curie could avoid it, but so that Citra could experience it and learn how to show compassion in the face of tragedy. It was emotionally exhausting, but rewarding. It was preparing her to be a scythe. Only one time did her post-gleaning experience differ. The first part of her job was tracking down the immediate family of the gleaned. There was one woman who seemed to have no immediate family, just one estranged brother. It was odd in this time when extended families were more often than not a convoluted web that spanned six living generations or more.
Yet this poor woman had only a brother. Citra mapped out the address, went there, but wasn't paying all that much attention. She didn't know where she was until she was right in front of the place. It wasn't a home, not in the traditional sense. It was a monastery. A walled adobe compound, styled after the historical missions. But unlike those ancient structures, the symbol at the apex of the central steeple was not a cross, but a two-pronged tuning fork. The bident. It was a sign of the tone cults. This was a tonist monastery. Citra shivered in the way anyone shivers at the prospect of something vaguely alien and darkly mystic.
"Stay away from those lunatics," her father once told her. "People get sucked in and are never seen again,"
which was a ridiculous thing to say. No one truly disappears in this day and age. The Thunderhead knows exactly where everyone is, at all times. Of course, it doesn't have to tell. Under other circumstances, Citra might have heeded her father's advice. But she was making a bereavement call, and that trumped any trepidation. She entered the compound through a gated arch. The gate wasn't locked. She found herself in a garden full of white, rich-smelling flowers. Gardenias. Tone cults were all about aroma and sounds. They gave little value to the sense of sight. In fact, the more extreme tonist groups actually blinded themselves, and the Thunderhead reluctantly allowed it, preventing their healing nanites from restoring sight. It was awful, and yet was one of the few expressions of religious freedom left in a world that had laid its various gods to rest. Citra followed a stone path through the garden to the church, on which stood the sign of the fork, and she pushed her way through the heavy oak doors into a chapel lined with pews. It was dim, even though there were stained glass windows on either side. They were not from the mortal age, but were tonist in nature. They depicted various strange scenes. A shirtless man, carrying a huge tuning fork on his burdened back. A stone, fracturing and shooting forth bolts of lightning. Crowds running from a nasty vermiform creature in the form of a double helix that spiraled out of the ground. She didn't like the images, and didn't know what these people believed, only that it was laughable. Ludicrous. Everyone knew that this so-called religion was just a hodgepodge of mortal age faiths slapped together into a troubling mosaic. Yet somehow, there were people who found that strange, ideological mosaic to be enticing. A priest, or monk, or whatever you call a cult clergyman, was at the altar, chanting in monotone, and dousing lit candles one by one.
"Excuse me,"
Citra said. Her voice was much louder than she meant it to be, a trick of the chapel's acoustics. The man wasn't startled by her. He put out one more candle, then set down his silver snuffer, and hobbled toward her with a pronounced limp. She wondered if it was affected, or if his religious freedom allowed him to retain whatever scarring caused the limp. By the wrinkles on his face, she could tell that he was long overdue to turn a corner.
"I am Curate Beauregard," he said. "Have you come for atonement?"
"No,"
she told him, showing her armband that bore the seal of Scythes.
"I need to speak to Robert Ferguson."
"Brother Ferguson is in afternoon repose. I shouldn't disturb him."
"It's important,"
she told him. The curate sighed.
"Very well, that which comes can't be avoided."
Then he hobbled off, leaving Citra alone. She looked around, taking in the strange surroundings. The altar in the front contained a granite basin filled with water, but the water was cloudy and foul-smelling. Just behind that was the focal point of the entire church, a steel, two-pronged fork, similar to the one on the roof outside. This bident was 6 feet tall and protruded from an obsidian base. Beside it, on its own little platform, sat a rubber mallet resting on a black velvet pillow. But it was the bident that held her attention. The huge tuning fork was cylindrical, silvery smooth, and cold to the touch.
"You want to strike it, don't you? Go on, it's not forbidden."
Citra jumped, and silently chided herself for being caught off guard.
"I am Brother Ferguson," said the man as he approached. "You wanted to see me?"
"I am the apprentice of Honorable Scythe Marie Curie,"
Citra told him.
"I've heard of her."
"I'm here on a bereavement mission."
"Go on."
"I'm afraid that your sister, Marissa Ferguson, was gleaned by Scythe Curie today at 1:15 p.m. I'm very sorry for your loss."
The man didn't seem upset or shocked, merely resigned. Is that all?
Is that all? Didn't you hear me? I just told you that your sister was gleaned today.
The man sighed. That which comes can't be avoided. If she didn't already dislike the Tonists, she certainly did now.
Is that it?
She asked.
Is that your people's holy line?
It's not a line. It's just a simple truth we live by.
Yeah, whatever you say. You'll need to make arrangements for your sister's body because that's coming and can't be avoided either.
But if I don't step forward, won't the Thunderhead provide a funeral?
Don't you care at all?
The man took a moment before answering. Death by scythe is not a natural death. We Tonists do not acknowledge it. Citra cleared her throat, biting back the verbal reaming she wanted to give him, and did her best to remain professional.
There's one more thing. Although you didn't live with her, you are her only documented relative. That entitles you to a year of immunity from gleaning.
I don't want immunity, he said.
Why am I not surprised?
This was the first time she had ever encountered anyone who refused immunity. Even the most downhearted would kiss the ring. You've done your job. You may go now, Brother Ferguson said. There was only so long Citra could restrain her frustration. She couldn't yell at the man. She couldn't use her Bucator moves to kick him in the neck or take him down with an elbow slam. So she did the only thing she could do. She picked up the mallet and put all of her anger into a single, powerful strike at the tuning fork. The fork resounded so powerfully she could feel it in her teeth and her bones. It rang not like a bell, which was a hollow sound. This tone was full and dense. It shocked the anger right out of her, diffused it. It made her muscles loosen, her jaw unclench. It echoed in her brain, her gut, and her spine. The tone rang much longer than such a thing should, then slowly began to fade. She had never experienced anything that was quite so jarring and soothing at the same time. All she could say was,
"What was that?"
"G-sharp," said Brother Ferguson, although there's a standing argument among the brethren that it's actually A-flat. The fork was still ringing faintly. Citra could see it vibrating, making its edge look blurry. She touched it, and the moment she did, it fell silent. "You have questions," said Brother Ferguson. "I'll answer what I can." Citra wanted to deny that she had any questions whatsoever, but suddenly she found that she did.
"What do you people believe?"
"We believe many things."
"Tell me one."
"We believe that flames were not meant to burn forever." Citra looked to the candles by the altar.
"Is that why the curate was dousing candles?"
"Part of our ritual, yes."
"So you worship darkness?"
"No," he said. "That's a common misconception. People use that to vilify us. What we worship are the wavelengths and vibrations that are beyond the limits of human sight. We believe in the great vibration, and that it will free us from being stagnant."
Stagnant.
It was the word Scythe Curie used to describe the people she chose to glean. Brother Ferguson smiled. "Indeed. Something resonates in you now, doesn't it?" She looked away, not wanting to meet his intrusive gaze, and found her eyes settling on the stone basin. She pointed to it.
"What's with the dirty water?"
"That's primordial ooze. It's brimming with microbes. Back in the age of mortality, this single basin could have wiped out entire populations. It was called disease."
"I know what it was called."
He dipped his finger in the slimy water and swirled it around. "Smallpox, polio, Ebola, anthrax. They're all in there. But it's harmless to us now. We couldn't get sick if we wanted to." He raised his finger from the foul sludge and licked it off. "I could drink down the whole bowl, and it wouldn't give me indigestion. Alas, we can no longer turn water into worm." Citra left without another word, and without turning back. But for the rest of the day, she couldn't get the stench of that foul-smelling water out of her nostrils. "The business of the Thunderhead is no business of mine. The Thunderhead's purpose is to sustain humanity. Mine is to mold it. The Thunderhead is the root, and I am the shears, pruning the limbs into fine form, keeping the tree vital. We are both necessary,
and we are mutually exclusive. I do not miss my so-called relationship with the Thunderhead, nor do the junior scythes I've come to see as disciples. The absence of the Thunderhead's uninvited intrusions into our lives is a blessing, for it allows us to live without a safety net, without the crutch of a higher power. I am the highest power I know, and I like it that way. And as for my gleaning methods, which now and then have been brought under scrutiny, I say merely this. Is it not the job of the gardener to shape the tree as much as possible? And shouldn't branches that begin to reach unreasonably high be the first to be pruned? From the Gleaning Journal of H.S. Goddard. 23. The Virtual Rabbit Hole. Just down the hall from Citra's room was a study. Like every other room in the residence, it had windows on multiple sides, and like everything else in Scythe Curie's life, was kept in perfect order. There was a computer interface there, which Citra used for her studies, because unlike Faraday, Scythe Curie did not shun the digital when it came to learning. As a Scythe's apprentice, Citra had access to databases and information that most people didn't. The backbrain, it was called. All the raw data within the Thunderhead's memory that was not organized for human consumption. Before her apprenticeship, when she did a standard search for things, the Thunderhead would invariably intrude, saying something like, "I see you are searching for a gift. May I ask for whom? Perhaps I can help you find something appropriate." Sometimes she would let the Thunderhead help her. Other times she enjoyed searching alone. But since becoming a Scythe's apprentice, the Thunderhead had gone disturbingly mute, as if it were nothing more than its data. "You'll have to get used to that," Scythe Faraday had told her early on. "Scythes cannot speak to the Thunderhead, and it will not speak to us. But in time, you'll come to appreciate the silence and self-reliance that comes from its absence." Now more than ever, she could have used the Thunderhead's AI guidance as she browsed through its data files, because the worldwide public camera system seemed designed to thwart her efforts. Her attempt to track Scythe Faraday's movements on the day he died was proving harder than she thought. Video records in the back brain were not organized by camera, or even by location. It seemed the Thunderhead linked them by concept. A moment of identical traffic patterns in completely different parts of the world were linked. Footage featuring people with similar strides were linked. One strand of associations led to images of increasingly spectacular sunsets, all caught by street cams. The Thunderhead's digital memory, Citra came to realize, was structured like a biological brain. Every moment of every video record was connected to 100 others by different criteria, which meant that every connection Citra followed led her down a rabbit hole of virtual neurons. It was like trying to read someone's mind by dissecting their cerebral cortex. It was maddening. The Scythedom, she knew, had created its own algorithms for searching the unsearchable contents of the backbrain. But Citra couldn't ask Scythe Curie without making her suspicious. The woman had already proven that she could see through any lie Citra put forth, so best not to be in a position where Citra would have to lie. The search began as a project, quickly evolved into a challenge, and now was an obsession. Citra would secretly spend an hour or two each day trying to find footage of Scythe Faraday's final movements, but to no avail. She wondered if, even in its silence, the Thunderhead was watching what she did. "My, oh my, you've been picking through my brain," it would say if it were allowed, with a virtual wink. "Naughty, naughty." Then, after many weeks, Citra had an epiphany. If everything uploaded to the Thunderhead was stored in the back brain, then not just public records were there, but personal as well. She couldn't access other people's private records, but anything she uploaded would be available to her. Which meant she could seed the search with data of her own.
"There's no actual law that says I can't visit my family while I'm an apprentice."
Citra brought it up in the middle of dinner one night, with neither warning nor context of conversation. It was her intent to blindside Scythe Curie with it. She could tell it worked, because of the length of time it took Scythe Curie to respond. She took 2 whole spoonfuls of soup before saying a thing.
"It's our standard practice, and a wise one if you ask me. It's cruel."
"Didn't you already attend a family wedding?" Citra wondered how Scythe Curie knew that, but wasn't about to let herself be derailed.
In a few months, I might die. I think I should have a right to see my family a few times before then.
Scythe Curie took two more spoonfuls of soup before saying,
I'll consider it.
In the end, she agreed, as Citra knew she would. After all, Scythe Curie was a fair woman, and Citra had not lied. She did want to see her family, so the Scythe could not read deceit in Citra's face because there was none. But of course, seeing her family wasn't Citra's only reason for going home. Everything on Citra's street looked the same as she and Scythe Curie strode down it, yet everything was different. A faint sense of longing tugged at her, but she couldn't be sure what she longed for. All she knew was that walking down her street suddenly felt like she was walking in some foreign land, where the people spoke a language she didn't know. They rode the elevator up to Citra's apartment with a pudgy woman, with a pudgier pug who was positively terrified. The woman, not the dog. The dog couldn't care less. Mrs. Yeltner, that was her name. Before Citra left home, Mrs. Yeltner had reset her lipid point to svelte. But apparently the procedure was struggling against a gluttonous appetite, because she was bulging in all the wrong places.
Hello, Mrs. Yeltner,
Citra said, guilty to be enjoying the woman's thinly veiled terror.
Good to see you,
she said, clearly not remembering Citra's name.
Wasn't there just a gleaning on your floor earlier this year? I didn't think it was allowed to hit the same building so soon. It's allowed,
Citra said.
But we're not here to glean today.
Although, added Scythe Curie, anything's possible. When the elevator reached her floor, Mrs. Yeltner actually tripped over her dog in her hurry to get out. It was a Sunday. Both of Citra's parents and her brother were home, waiting. The visit wasn't a surprise, but there was surprise on her father's face when he opened the door.
Hi, Dad,
Citra said. He took her into his arms in a hug that felt warm, but yet obligatory as well.
We've missed you, honey,
said her mother, hugging her as well. Ben kept his distance and just stared at the Scythe.
We were expecting Scythe Faraday, her father said to the lavender-clad woman.
Long story, said Citra. I have a new mentor now.
And Ben blurted out,
You're Scythe Curie. Ben, chided their mother, don't be rude. But you are, aren't you? I've seen pictures, you're famous.
The Scythe offered a modest grin.
Infamous is more accurate.
Mrs. Terranova gestured to the living room.
Please, come in.
But Scythe Curie never crossed the threshold.
I have business elsewhere, she said.
But I'll return for Citra at dusk. She nodded to Citra's parents, winked at Ben, then turned to leave. The moment the door was closed, both her parents seemed to fold just a bit, as if they had been holding their breath.
I can't believe you're being taught by the Scythe Curie, the grandma of death. Grandam, not grandma. I didn't even know she still existed, said Citra's mom. Don't all scythes have to glean themselves eventually? We don't have to do anything, Citra said,
a little surprised at how little her parents really knew about how the scythedom worked.
Scythes only self-glean if they want to. Or if they're murdered, thought Citra.
Her room was the way she had left it, just cleaner.
And if you're not ordained, you can come home, and it will be like you never left, her mother said.
Citra didn't tell her that either way she would not be coming home. If she achieved scythehood, she would probably live with other junior scythes. And if she did not become an ordained scythe, she would not live at all. Her parents didn't need to know that.
It's your day, her father said. What would you like to do?
Citra rummaged through her desk drawer until she found her camera.
Let's go for a walk.
The small talk was of the microscopic variety. And although it was good to be with her family, never had the barrier between them felt denser. There were so many things she wished she could talk about, but they'd never understand, never be able to relate. She couldn't talk to her mother about the intricacies of Killcraft. She couldn't commiserate with her father about that moment when life left a person's eyes. Her brother was the only one she felt remotely comfortable talking to.
I had a dream that you came to my school and gleaned all the jerks, he told her. Really?
Citra said.
What color were my robes?
He hesitated.
Turquoise, I think. Then that will be the color I'll choose.
Ben beamed.
What will we call you once you're ordained?
her father said, treating it as if it were a certainty. Citra hadn't even considered the question. She never heard a Scythe referred to by anything but their patron historic, or your honor. Were family members bound to that as well? She hadn't even chosen her patron yet. She dodged the question by saying,
"You're my family, you can call me whatever you like,"
hoping that was true. They strolled around town. Although she didn't tell them, they passed the small home where she had lived with Rowan and Scythe Faraday. They passed the train station nearest the home, and everywhere they went, Citra made a point to take a family picture, each from an angle very close to that of the nearest public camera. The day was emotionally exhausting. Citra wanted to stay longer, and yet a big part of her couldn't wait for Scythe Curie to arrive. She resolved not to feel guilty about that. She'd had more than her share of guilt. Guilt is the idiot cousin of remorse, Scythe Faraday had been fond of saying. Scythe Curie didn't ask Citra any questions about her visit on the way home, and Citra was content not to share. She did ask the Scythe something, though.
Does anyone ever call you by your name?
Other Scythes, ones I'm friendly with, will call me Marie.
As in Marie Curie?
My patron historic was a great woman. She coined the term radioactivity, and was the first woman to win the Nobel Prize, back when such things were awarded.
But what about your real name? The one you were born with?
Scythe Curie took her time in answering. Finally, she said, "There's no one in my life who knows me by that name."
What about your family? They must be still around. After all, they have immunity from gleaning as long as you're alive.
She sighed. "I haven't been in touch with my family for more than 100 years. Citra wondered if that would happen to her. Do all Scythes lose the ties to everyone they had known, everything they had been before they were chosen?
Susan,
Scythe Curie finally said. When I was a little girl, they called me Susan.
Susie.
Sue.
It's a pleasure to meet you, Susan.
Citra found it next to impossible to imagine Scythe Curie as a little girl. When they got home, Citra uploaded her pictures to the Thunderhead without worrying if the Scythe saw, because there was nothing unusual or suspicious about that. Everyone uploaded their photos. It would have been suspicious if she hadn't. Then, later that night, when Citra was sure Scythe Curie was asleep, she went to the study, got online and retrieved the pics, which was easy to do since they were tagged. Then she dove into the back brain, following all the links the Thunderhead had forged to her images. She was led to other pictures of her family, as well as other families that resembled hers in some way. Expected. But there were also links to videos taken by street cams in the same locations. That's just what she was looking for. Once she created her own algorithm to sort out the irrelevant photos from the street cams, she had a full complement of surveillance videos. Of course, she was still left with millions of randomly accessed, unordered files, but at least now they were all street cam records of Scythe Faraday's neighborhood. She uploaded an image of Scythe Faraday to see if she could isolate videos in which she appeared, but as she suspected, nothing came back. The Thunderhead's hands-off policy when it came to Scythes meant that Scythe's images were not tagged in any way. Still, she had successfully narrowed the field from billions of records to millions. However, tracking Scythe Faraday's movements on the day he died was like trying to find a needle in a field of haystacks that stretched to the horizon. Even so, she was determined to find what she was looking for, no matter how long it took.
Gleanings should be iconic. They should be memorable. They should have the legendary power of the greatest battles of the mortal age, passed down by word of mouth, becoming as immortal as we are. That is, after all, why we Scythes are here. To keep us connected to our past, tethered to mortality. Yes, most of us will live forever, but some of us, thanks to the Scythedom, will not. For those who will be gleaned, do we not, at the very least, owe them a spectacular end? From the Gleaning Journal of H.S. Goddard. 24. An embarrassment to who and what we are. Numb. Rowan could feel himself growing numb. And while it might have been a good thing for his beleaguered sanity, it was not a good thing for his soul. Never lose your humanity, Scythe Faraday had told him, or you'll be nothing more than a killing machine.
He had used the word killing rather than gleaning. Rowan hadn't thought much of it at the time, but now he understood. It stopped being gleaning the moment one became desensitized to the act. Yet this great plane of numbness was not the worst place to be. Numbness was a mere purgatory of gray. No, there was a much worse place. Darkness, masquerading as enlightenment. It was a place of royal blue, studded with diamonds that glistened like stars.
No, no, no,
chided Scythe Goddard as he watched Rowan practice bladecraft with a samurai sword on cotton-stuffed dummies.
Have you learned nothing?
Rowan was exasperated, but he kept it just beneath a simmer, counting to 10 in his head, before turning to face the scythe, who approached across the expanse of the estate's front lawn, now littered with fluff and cottony remains.
What did I do wrong this time, Your Honor?
To Rowan, the phrase, Your Honor, had become a profanity, and he couldn't help but spit it out like one.
I cleanly decapitated 5 of them, eviscerated 3, and I severed the aortas of the rest. If any of them had actually been alive, they would be dead now. I did just what you wanted.
That's the problem, said the scythe. It's not what I want. It's what you want. Where is your passion? You attack like a bot.
Rowan scythed, sheathing his blade. Now would come a lecture, or more accurately, an oration, because Scythe Goddard loved nothing more than performing to the gallery, even if it was just a gallery of one.
Human beings are predatory by nature, he began. That nature may have been bleached out of us by the sanitizing force of civilization, but it can never be taken from us completely. Embrace it, Rowan. Suckle at its transformative breast. You may think gleaning is an acquired taste, but it's not. The thrill of the hunt and the joy of the kill simmers in all of us. Bring it to the surface, and then you'll be the kind of scythe this world needs.
Rowan wanted to despise all of this, but there was something about honing one's skill, no matter the nature of that skill, that was rewarding. What he hated was the fact that he didn't hate it. Servants replaced the dummies with fresh effigies, scarecrows with extremely short lifespans. Then Goddard took the samurai blade from him and handed him a nasty-looking hunting knife instead, for a more intimate delivery of death.
It's a bowie knife, like Texan scythes use, Goddard told him. Take great satisfaction and pleasure in this, Rowan, said Scythe Goddard, or you'll be nothing more than a killing machine.
Each day was the same. A morning run with Scythe Rand, weight training with Scythe Chomsky, and a nutritionally precise breakfast prepared by a master chef. Then would come killcraft, administered by Scythe Goddard himself. Blades, bows, ballistics, or the use of his own body as a weapon of death. Never poisons, unless they were on the tips of weapons.
Gleaning is performed, not administered, Scythe Goddard told him. It is a willful action. To slip into passivity and allow a poison to do all the work is an embarrassment to who and what we are.
Goddard's pontifications were constant, and although Rowan often disagreed, he didn't argue or voice his dissent. In this way, Goddard's voice began to supplant his own internal moderator. It became the voice of judgment in his own head. Rowan didn't know why this would be so, yet Goddard was now there in his head, passing judgment on everything he did. The afternoons would be filled with mental training with Scythe Volta, memory exercises, and games to increase cognitive acuity. The smallest part of Rowan's day, just before dinner, was spent in book learning, but Rowan found that the mental training helped him retain the things he learned without the repetition of study.
You will know your history, your biochemistry, and your toxins ad nauseam to impress at conclave,
Goddard told Rowan with a disgusted wave of his hand.
I've always found it pointless, but one must impress the academics and the scythedom as well as the pragmatists.
Is that what you are? Rowan asked. A pragmatist?
It was Volta who answered him.
Scythe Goddard is a visionary. That puts him on a level above every other scythe in Mid-America, maybe even the world.
Goddard didn't disagree. And then there were the parties. They came upon the estate like seizures. Everything else stopped. They even took precedence over Rowan's training. He had no idea who organized them or where the revelers came from, but they always came, along with food enough to feed armies and every sort of decadence. Rowan didn't know if it was his imagination, but there seemed to be more scythes and known celebrities frequenting Goddard's parties than when he first arrived. In 3 months, the change in Rowan's physique was obvious, and he spent more time than he would want anyone to know studying the change in the tall mirror in his bedroom. There was definition everywhere. His abs, his pecs, biceps seemed to inflate out of nowhere. And Scythe Rand constantly slapped his glutes, threatening all sorts of lewd liaisons with him once he was of age. He had finally gotten the hang of his journal, writing things that bordered on thoughtful. But it was still just a sham. He never wrote what he truly felt, for he knew that his private journal was not private at all, and that Scythe Goddard read every last word. So he wrote only things that Goddard would want to read. Although Rowan did not forget his secret pledge to throw the scythehood to Citra, there were moments when he willfully suppressed it in his mind, allowing himself to imagine what it would be like to be an ordained scythe. Would he be the type of scythe Faraday was? Or would he accept the teachings of Goddard? As much as Rowan tried to deny it, there was logic to Goddard's approach. After all, what creature in nature despised its own existence and felt shame for its means of survival? "We became unnatural the moment we conquered death," Scythe Faraday would say. But couldn't that be a reason to seek whatever nature we could find within ourselves? If he learned to enjoy gleaning, would it be such a tragedy? He kept these thoughts to himself. But Scythe Volta could read, if not the specifics, then the general nature of his thoughts. "I know you were first brought on as an apprentice for very different traits than the ones Scythe Goddard admires," Volta told him. "He sees compassion and forbearance as weakness. But you have other traits that are beginning to awaken. You'll be a new order scythe yet." Of all Goddard's junior scythes, Volta was the most admirable, and the one Rowan most related to. He imagined they might be friends once they were equals. "Do you remember the pain when we beat you down?" Volta asked one afternoon at the end of memory training. "How could I ever forget?" "There are three reasons for it," Volta told him. "The first is to connect you with our ancestors, reliving the pain and the fear of pain, because that's what led to civilization and humanity's advancement beyond its own mortality. The second is a rite of passage, something sorely missing in our passive world. But the third reason may be the most important. Being made to suffer pain frees us to feel the joy of being human." To Rowan, it sounded like more empty platitudes, but Volta wasn't like Goddard that way. He didn't usually speak in lofty, meaningless ideas. "I felt plenty of joy in my life without having to be beaten to a pulp," Rowan told him. Volta nodded. "You felt some, but just a shadow of what it can be. Without the threat of suffering, we can't experience true joy. The best we get is pleasantness." Rowan had no response to that, because it struck him as true. He had led a pleasant life. His biggest complaint was being marginalized. But didn't everyone feel marginalized? They lived in a world where nothing anyone did really mattered. Survival was guaranteed. Income was guaranteed. Food was plentiful and comfort was a given. The Thunderhead saw to everyone's needs. When you need nothing, what else can life be but pleasant?
"You'll get it eventually," Scythe Volta told him. "Now that your pain nanites are dialed to zero, it's inevitable."
Esme remained a mystery. Sometimes she came down to eat with them, sometimes she didn't. Sometimes Rowan would catch her reading in various places around the mansion. Mortal Age books made of paper that had apparently been collected by the owner before he surrendered it all to Scythe Goddard. She would always hide from him whatever it was she was reading, as if embarrassed by it.
"When you become a scythe, are you going to stay?"
she asked him. "Maybe," he told her, "and maybe not. Maybe I won't get to be a scythe, so maybe I'll be nowhere." She ignored that last part of his answer.
"You should stay,"
she told him. The fact that this 9-year-old girl seemed to have a crush on him was one more complication Rowan didn't need.
She seemed to get everything she wanted. So did that mean she got him if she wanted that too?
My name is Esmeralda, but everyone...